you kindly put mine first? And I'll heal. I have a lot of things that will go. Hopefully, it will work out.
Perfect.
Just can you move just once, look?
It's a bit tight.
Okay.
Not a Mac person. If I actually, I'm going to leave that on. I'm going to go over to the computer, make sure
it
works.
No problem.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Bonsoir. I think there's still some people registering, so we'll wait a few more minutes, but we'll start. As soon as I have the okay, we're going to go. Okay.
Are you ready, Will?
Almost.
Okay. Give me.
Bonsoir. Welcome to this new season of the Goodman Cancer Lectures. And we have nicely named it Cancer, a Disease of a Thousand Faces. It means a lot about science, a lot about people also. And we have four lectures in the coming year to entertain you, inform you, and hopefully be a useful group for you. I'm just being told on the air that normally we're not supposed to eat in that room. So we're all going to be in trouble if you don't pick up your things at the end. We'll try our best and also try to do that. It's the famous conference room for the dean. And so if you can help us, that'll be good. But no problem. We'll look at that afterwards. So I have a few slides to start. Let me see. Another microphone, or is this the only one?
Do you want the wireless?
Yeah, I think people may want the wireless.
Two seconds.
Okay.
Okay,
but what do you mean?
There we are. This is it?
Yep. Are you going to have enough battery at the end with all the questions we're going to have?
Hope so.
I'm not as old as I am. Okay, that's good. Okay. Hello. You're here? No. On. We're getting there. Yeah. You hear me well?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. So we'll get it. We'll get started. In fact, I thought I had done my days of being the presentation the presenter for this Goodman evening. I was replaced very nicely by Dr. Beauchemin. And you'll hear that Dr. Beauchemin is one of our speakers tonight. And she will be telling us her témoignage about her own cancer. And so it's very exciting, Nicole, that you're here contributing to a different part of your life that we know less. And really appreciate that you're here tonight. So I have to move on because we have a lot of people to several things to talk about. So we'll have three speakers tonight: Molecular Aspect of Breast Cancer by Dr. Park, Peter Segal, which will talk about metastasis in breast cancer. He's been working on this for years, and I think he has very interesting things to tell us. And finally, our clinician scientist, Mark Basic, from the Segal Cancer Center, which will come and tell us a bit more about current treatment and what's happening now. I have to, though, announce the next session. So you have, I think, you're invited to pre-register to the lymphoma, leukemia, and hematological cancer. That's the next series that we'll have. So you can pre-register if you want when you go out. That'll be nice. What else I have to say to you? Another thing which is important, I think, I'm not sure if I have this here, so we have to talk about Morag. I'll come back to Morag a bit later. Here, this is important. So we have attached to our website at the Goodman Cancer Center some resources, some website. So I just invite you to go. So this is the main home URL for the Cancer Center, for the Goodman Cancer Center. If you click on that, you'll end up with this page. And if you see, I'm going to try to, a bit rusty the guy. If you click here, public events, I'll go to change the slide, it would be a bit easier. So you end up at this page, which is public event, and you click, you look at public forum. So there's a three things, public forum. And here in the bottom on the website, you'll have three sites that you can have information. The Breast Cancer Society of Canada, also ahead here that you can learn about. And it's moving. This is great. And the Quebec Breast Cancer Foundation. And also more daily or down-to-earth answers. What is breast cancer? What causes breast cancer? Sur ces sites-là aussi, c'est en français. Donc, vous pouvez aussi aller du côté français si vous avez besoin. Donc, we welcome you to look at that if you have more information about this topic tonight. We take a few minutes to, as you know, we have a new director in the Cancer Center, for those of you that know. So, Dr. Park, and I was asked to put a few things as a surprise for Morag. Nothing too damaging, no, on the contrary, very complimentary. So, who is Morag Park? Born in Scotland. So that's a bit easy for you guys to know as soon as she starts speaking. Although I did not know myself. I thought she was coming from Australia or something when I knew her. And I didn't know Scotland like it was Newfoundland or a piece of rock, but I'm learning now. There's also whiskey there, but that's another thing. Her undergraduate was University of Glasgow. And when I saw that picture, I understood a bit later, you'll see she'll end up in Montreal at the Royal Vic. So that explained a bit. She felt a bit lonely in Canada, probably. So the point is that she did her PhD degree also in Glasgow, but you noticed that I changed the building. So it was a bit more research then. So that was interesting. She did research, and we'll show you what. If those of you that can recognize this, it's a virus. It's a herpes simplex virus. In the old days, our generations used to work on tumor viruses. Tumor DNA viruses, and we learned a lot from viruses at those days. And Morag was a specialist of HSV. And she moved to the U.S., the first National Institute of Health in Bethesda, and afterwards very close by at the National Cancer Institute in Frederick, Maryland. This was for her postdoc training, and that's where she encountered c-MET oncogene. C-MET oncogene has been the lightning rod for Morag's research for the past 30 years. And I think she'll probably mention a bit of that today, maybe not. But definitively, her marks in the world of science and cancer is definitively associated with c-MET oncogene. Few things I'd like to say. So she came to McGill in 1989. And this is not, of course, Glasgow. It's in fact Royal Victoria, a very interesting building. And she moved to the new building in 2008 with all of us, with all the group of the molecular oncology group from the Royal Vic here in the cancer building. A few things that she did, the director through the years, and you'll see why she was chosen as the director of the Goodman Cancer Center. She was the director of the molecular oncology group, a very efficient, productive group at Royal Vic, but together with the old McGill Cancer Center, it certainly was a marriage made in heaven. Oh no, on Mont Royal, but that's the same. She also became director of the Canadian Cancer Institute of CIHR. This is the highest instance of research in cancer in Canada, and she led this for five years. So it certainly made her know the entire country and different parts of research from prevention to hardcore molecular biology to also end-of-life research. So she did a fantastic job there. And, of course, that's why she was chosen director of the Goodman Cancer Center from the committee, which she started last summer. A few things I'd like to say. First is she has a boyfriend, which is very important. And in fact, it's her companion for many, many years. Her husband, Alain Neveu, is also a professor here at the Goodman Cancer Center. So I was talking about marriage and heaven. This is one. The other thing, this was the first Goodman Gala, by the way. So that was a fantastic event. And the last 2 years ago already... just before I got my heart attack coming back to Japan, was a fantastic party too, I must say. And a few things more scientific now. Morag has over 150 papers in cancer research, and some of them are outstanding papers. All of them outstanding papers. She's been grant funded for over 30 years, 50 trainees as she trains and move on to be cancer research around the world. And she, of course, did multiple seminars around the world and many things. She's also the Guerra chair. And what was I going to say? Amongst all the papers, I added this one because this is a famous paper for the Cancer Center and for Morag particularly, where she showed in Nature Medicine that the environment of the tumor was as important as the tumor itself to decide the outcome of that. And this is a fantastic initiation of all the things that now we are looking at in terms of the environment of the tumor. So all of this was to welcome you, Morag, officially to the Cancer Center. And for that, my dear colleague Nicole has something for you. So if you can come quickly. And we're almost there. We'll start the evening. I'm sorry. It's just we'll get there. You'll see we're very frugal in our gift, but with lots of heart.
Where's the microphone? When Morag came in, we switched from a guy's office to a girl's office. So she got lots of plants. And I couldn't resist getting her a small plant that she's going to nurture and she's going to grow. And I promise to go by her office at least once a week to water it because she will forget.
But it does match my jacket. Thank you.
Yes.
Oh, wow. We're color coordinated now at the Cancer Center.
The plant and you—that's really nice. That's great. So, so we have our first talk then. Dr. Morag Park, the facet moléculaire du cancer du sein, molecular aspect of breast cancer, and Morag, thank you very much for starting the year.
So thanks very much. I'll get myself out of all these photographs of me. Yeah, I put my pink jacket on, and I realize that now I can hardly fasten it. So there's a lesson. Never become a director of anything. Right. We have to breathe in. So I think I'll just add something to Michelle, and I want to thank Michelle for that wonderful and rather generous introduction. And he said that I may be lonely off Scotland by coming to the Royal Victoria Hospital to work. And I think I have to add something else. The Royal Victoria Hospital is a replica of a hospital in Edinburgh in Scotland. And I was actually born in that hospital in Edinburgh in Scotland. And 30 years later, I came to work at the Royal Victoria Hospital in Montreal. So I think there's something going on there. And I didn't come up to Montreal for any other reason. I drove up here, and I think, oh, my goodness, I don't know anybody in Montreal. But I have to say that I've absolutely thoroughly enjoyed myself. I love Montreal, and it's been a fantastic environment for me. So I'm really thrilled to be able to give the first talk this evening and to join with others in McGill and in the hospitals at McGill that will follow me in this talk. And it's a really important area for us to discuss. I don't like what happened there. That's not where I should be. I'm at the end. That's the problem. Here we go. Okay. And although Michelle said I may talk about some of my work, I decided not really to talk so much about the work that we're doing in the lab. I'll highlight some aspects, and if people want to ask questions, I'm happy to answer questions. But since the title of the talk was Molecular Basis of Breast Cancer, I thought it would be important to try and give you an understanding of the directions that we're moving in, the types of discoveries that have been made in the last 20 years, and this is a slow process, but how that's changing how we treat and think about breast cancer. And you'll hear about the treatment from Mark Bezik, who will highlight the new types of protocols that are being used and that are coming into the clinic. So I'm sorry about these transitions. This is, I don't know how to get rid of them. So I think it's important to say, why should we study breast cancer? Breast cancer is the most frequent form of cancer affecting women in North America. That's 1 in 9 women in North America will develop breast cancer in their lifetime. And although we've made huge advances in treating breast cancer and in early detection of breast cancer, but because it's such a frequent disease, it is still the second... It's on an automatic. I may have to... Yeah. It's still the second most common cause of cancer death for women in North America. So this is a real challenge for us, both to understand the disease, but obviously how to treat the disease, and for the healthcare system as well, because we must think of the impact on the healthcare system. So I think where we're at now is an understanding that breast cancer is not one disease. It's multiple types of diseases. And if we think of the population of women who will develop breast cancer in their lifetime, the ladies in pink will develop breast cancer that's of one type. The ladies in gray will develop breast cancer that's of a different type and has to be treated in a different way. And the ladies in black, I think, or dark gray on that slide, will develop breast cancer of another type, and we have to think about treating that in a different way. So what becomes really important is, how do we identify those different types of breast cancers? How do we know when a woman goes to the clinic that her breast cancer is of one particular type and should be treated in one particular way, or at least in several ways, but focused on one area? So breast cancer develops from what are called epithelial cells in the breasts, and these are normal tubes and ducts. That's where the milk comes when you're feeding, when you're pregnant. You can frequent... Oh, God. I don't know if anybody knows how to get out of this timed system. No. Well, I'll maybe just have to keep going back. I didn't realize it was on a timer. Anyway, let's just keep going. You can frequently detect breast cancer, but not always, for example, by a mammogram. The tumors are then removed surgically, or sometimes you'll take a biopsy, and Mark may talk about the biopsies that they're doing at the moment. What's important for us is, once the tumor's removed, we can begin to look at it. And this, the we here, is in pathology, of course. The first place these tumors go to is pathology, where they'll take a section and they'll characterize the tumor. In pathology, you can detect the tumor cells. That's these sort of dark blue cells. And then there are other cells that are present in the tumor, but these are normal cells. And we know that these normal cells are essential for the tumor to grow. And that's what Michelle was talking about, the stroma. So we've characterized the normal cells, but I won't talk very much about it. But I'll come back to it, and just to point that out. So the question now is, how do we show that this tumor belongs to either this subtype or this subtype or that subtype? And how have people done this? So they've done this by using what are called molecular markers. So these are markers that you can use for tests in pathology, and they can identify the difference between one tumor that belongs to one subtype or another tumor that belongs to another subtype. And many of you will have heard about these markers, and we can begin to look at tumors using these. So for example, some women's tumors are positive for a marker that's called the estrogen receptor. We know that in those tumors, the estrogen receptor is important for the proliferation of these tumor cells. Now, by studies in the lab, this is not our work, but the work of many researchers over the years. I think if I go back, it's all right. Many researchers over the years have developed antagonists, so compounds that will inhibit the function of the estrogen receptor, One of these is called tamoxifen. And I think Mark will tell you about new types of compounds to treat this type of cancer. The estrogen receptor positive subtype of breast cancer is found in about 60 to 70% of women that develop breast cancer. Now, what's important is some tumors are not positive for the estrogen receptor. They're called estrogen receptor negative. Another subtype of breast cancer, so for example, these women develop breast cancer that tends to be negative for the estrogen receptor, but it's positive for another receptor. It's called the HER2 receptor. These tumors are not positive for the HER2 receptor. So straight away, we can now identify three subtypes of breast cancer that look very different at the level of pathology if you stain them for these markers. What's been important in the last 15 years or so is that the HER2-positive patients can now be treated with an inhibitor of HER2, so something that antagonizes the HER2 molecular target, and this is called Herceptin. And you may have heard about this. This is now provided and supported by the healthcare system in Canada, but not healthcare systems everywhere. And that's a really important point because these drugs are quite expensive. Now, what's important to think about is the estrogen receptor positive patients tend to have the best outcome. And that's in part because you can treat them with tamoxifen. It targets the estrogen receptor. And this has been used now for many years, for 15 years or so. The HER2 positive patients tended to have a poor outcome, but now that Herceptin is available and these patients can be identified, it's clear that the outcome of these women is getting better. The challenge for us at the moment is this type of cancer that's called triple negative. It's negative for the estrogen receptor, negative for the HER2 receptor, so we can't treat it. We don't yet know how to specifically target this subtype of breast cancer. Now, I wanted to just give you an example of the sort of timeline that it takes from the discoveries that we make in the lab to the treatment of breast cancer. So, for example, the HER2 receptor, this is a protein that's on the membrane. We don't really need to understand it, but the important thing to say is that it can be targeted, and it's targeted with Herceptin, and that's a molecule that inhibits the function of that receptor. So this is a normal functioning receptor. It becomes amplified. It was first identified in the 1980s. Round about the 1990s, some of the first clinical trials were developed using the inhibitors Herceptin. It took from the 1990s up to 2005, for example, for Herceptin to move into the clinic. It must go through clinical trials, so it must be tested in very carefully controlled conditions, shown to actually improve quality of life and outcome, before it will then be supported for the healthcare system and by Health Canada in Canada. Now, what's important to point out is you can't just treat anybody with Herceptin. You must identify if their tumors are positive for the HER2 receptor. So this is now an immunohistochemistry test that's done in the pathology department to identify those women that could respond to Herceptin. There's no use giving it to these women because their tumors are not dependent on the HER2 target. What's also important is there are other types of tests that you can run because you want to be really confident that you're targeting the right people because there's always side effects. And this is another clinical test. These are called companion diagnostics. So that means you have to be positive for the clinical test to be eligible to get Herceptin. This is a test that's called fluorescent in situ hybridization. It's called FISH. But it's just a test to look at the tumor cells, and these are the tumor cells in a section that you'll find in pathology. These little green dots show that these tumor cells are very positive for the HER2 receptor, whereas these tumor cells are not. So that's a second test that you can use to identify that subtype of breast cancer and target those women for treatment with Herceptin. So this has been, over the last 20 years, you could say a real advance. This is personalized therapy. it's the beginning of personalized therapy. And breast cancer is the first cancer that's really been used to identify the specific subtypes of cancer that will respond to specific treatment protocols. The challenge, though, is that sometimes women with ER-positive disease don't respond to tamoxifen. Sometimes women with HER2-positive disease don't respond to Herceptin. And as I said, what do we do with these cancers, the triple-negative cancers, and we don't yet have a real target for them? So what's happened in the last 10 years is a bit of a revolution. And it's based on the new types of technologies that are based on the sort of genomics revolution that we've heard about. So many of you may have heard that we've sequenced the whole human genome. We can actually sequence cancer genomes now. At the moment, there's a worldwide initiative to sequence thousands and thousands and thousands of cancer genomes. There will be 500 breast cancers sequenced of the ER-positive subtype, 500 that are sequenced of the HER2-positive subtype. So we're beginning to really understand the complexities of the disease and identify new types of markers that we can use to target the disease. Now, this is based on the ability to bank tissue. So about 15 years ago, we started to bank breast cancer tissue from individuals that go to the Royal Victoria Hospital. We bank this. This is tissue that is usually in pathology extra tissue that's not used for anything. It's not used for diagnosis. And we bank it under really carefully controlled conditions. So we monitor the time from surgery to when the tissue is banked so that we know that the quality is good. We capture the information of the patients. This is all behind a firewall, so we don't link the patient information with the other type of information, but it gives us the fact that we can understand the clinical variables and the outcome of each of these individuals, how they respond to treatment. We can then use these types of omic technologies. And here, what I'm showing you, we've set up this technology, the Goodman Cancer Center, and we can capture a snapshot of that tumor. And what we're capturing is what we call gene expression changes. So what changes have occurred in that tumor when it's removed from the patient? So these changes that we're looking at are changes in gene expression. We've got 50,000 genes that can be expressed or not expressed. And these can identify some of the changes that occur in that specific cancer. So this type of approach has been used by multiple labs. We can look at the tumor cells, that's what we do, or we can look at these other cells, the stroma cells, the normal cells that have to be present to help that cancer grow. So some of these studies were done about 10 years ago, and this is by an investigator called Therese Sorley. Now, the important thing here is you don't have to understand anything, but what that says is if the genes are highly expressed, they're red, and if they're not expressed, they're green. And what you can see is you get sort of patterns. So these tumors have high levels of these genes, but not these genes, whereas those tumors have high levels of those genes, but not those genes. And that's all you have to know. But what's important is that you begin to see the subtypes that I was telling you about. These are the HER2 tumors, these purple ones, so they look different from these blue ones over here. The luminal tumors are the estrogen receptor positive tumors. So what you can see is that the estrogen receptor positive tumors look very different from these HER2 amplified tumors. But this has given us a tool now to look at this other subtype that's called basal here, but this is the triple negative subtype, the subtype that we didn't really know anything about. So these types of strategies are actually now coming into the clinic. And this is really exciting, but it's also challenging. How do you bring these new tools into the clinic? So I told you we get different types of breast cancer, and I told you we can begin to look at them in pathology, but now we can use these molecular profiles. We can characterize them using these types of omics strategies that we use the fresh tissue from the patient. But what's important now is we can begin to use these types of technologies to begin to predict disease progression, which people would progress which people would have poor outcome. And what's very interesting is those types of gene expression signatures are now being used in the clinic, in clinical trials. So, for example, Oncotype DX is a number of genes that's used to predict good outcome for estrogen receptor positive tumors versus bad outcome. And in that context, you would pay more attention and treat those patients that are predicted to have poor outcome. The MammaPrint test is also in clinical trials. Again, this is designed to predict those patients who would progress to metastatic disease. So we've added our test in there too. This is looking at the stroma, the normal cells. These cells shouldn't change, but they do change, and the tumor actually recruits different normal cells to help it grow. So by looking at the normal cells, we can actually also look at gene expression profiles and identify predictors for poor outcome versus good outcome. This stroma predictor is now, we're now beginning to build tests that we can use this to predict outcome. But what becomes more important is how do we translate this back to the clinic? How do we use these wonderful tools, this fantastic technology that we can set up in our labs here? And students can use this, and the technical staff. How do we look at this triple negative subtype of breast cancer? So to do that, again, we've got to start with what we now call a systems biology approach to understand breast cancer. We can start with the patient tissue. I told you we started a tumor bank. So we can look at the patient's tissue. We can identify those patients that are triple negative, identified in pathology. We can capture that snapshot, the omics type of snapshot of changes that occur in these tumors. We could even sequence these tumors now, and these are the types of activities that we're now starting to do in the center. We can build animal models. We can actually make human tumors grow in mice. These are called patient-derived xenografts, and this is very exciting. And these are new types of approaches to identify how you could begin to treat those tumors. We can now look at how the mice respond to new therapeutic interventions by either growing the human tumors in mice or by developing mice themselves that develop breast cancer in their mammary glands. So we can take these types of approaches and use multiple different, what we now call iterative type of approaches, to try and tease out what are the markers that we can use and what are new targets, particularly for this triple negative subtype of breast cancer that we don't yet really have a good understanding of. And I just want to leave you with the last slide to show the types of things that we've done in the lab to understand triple negative breast cancer. So we actually started with a mouse model that developed cancer, breast cancer, that looked like triple negative. So we actually study this using gene expression, so the sort of omics technologies, and we find that it looks very similar to the human triple negative breast cancers that we've studied in our lab and that people have studied in other labs. With this, we identified that we could form these tumors using another receptor. This is called the MAT receptor, and Michelle said that I've worked on this for 25 years. It's a bit like the HER2 gene. What's important for us is that there are small molecule inhibitors of this gene that are in clinical trials at the moment for other cancer types. What we can do, we can go back to the pathology and show that in this triple negative breast cancer, it's very positive. This brown staining means it's positive for that receptor. So that means we've now got a tool that can identify some of these triple negative breast cancers, this receptor. Now, I told you there are small molecule inhibitors, and again, we can go back to our mouse models, and we can treat them with one of these inhibitors. And this is actually looking at the size of the tumors that are growing in mice that are still alive. We can treat them with an inhibitor, and what we see is that these tumors don't grow very much. So this is, you know, it's promising. It's not that we can take this into the clinic, but these are the types of tools that we're developing in the Goodman Cancer Center that will now allow us to understand how that triple negative breast cancer is caused and maybe identify new ways that we can treat triple negative breast cancer. Now, I think it's very important to highlight the most important people, and these are always the people that do the work. This isn't me. I just walk around with my pink jacket on. This is, you know, the people that work extremely hard. And these are not 9-to-5 folks. These are the folks that bank the tumors, make sure everything is absolutely perfect. And they work in the Goodman Cancer Center in what we call the Breast Cancer Functional Genomics Group. And then in addition to those folks, I have a lab in the Goodman Cancer Center. Again, in the lab, there's a bunch of students. We train the students in postdocs. And as Michelle said, this is the next generation. These are the researchers that will carry the torch. Hopefully we'll come back to Montreal, but they'll go elsewhere in the world and learn new technologies and bring exciting approaches back to the Goodman Cancer Center. And hopefully we'll still stay working on breast cancer. So thank you very much.
Please hold your questions. We'll do this at the end of the evening. And Morag would come back in front. We can ask your questions like Peter and Dr. Basic and Nicole also. So our second speaker tonight is Dr. Peter Siegel. He's an associate professor in the Department of Medicine and Biochemistry, anatomy and cell biology also, and oncology. You're paid by everybody, it looks like. So, and he was associate director. He's associate director now. He was interim director of the Goodman Cancer Center. And Peter works on metastatic breast cancer, les métastases du cancer du sein. And the title really is Understanding What Controls the Spread of Breast Cancer Cells. Comme vous savez, we understand that the cancer cells, that we've talked a lot about, we heard from Morag about the initial tumor and how to characterize it, how to treat it as fast as possible. But what also kills the patients and mainly is these metastases. So we do a lot of work on that, not only us, but many people around the world. And Peter is our specialist of metastases here in the Goodman. Peter, welcome.
Well, first of all, I want to thank all of you for coming out. This is the next session of our public forums. And I really want to thank the Goodman family for coming to us, identifying a need to help us explain to you how the work that we do in the labs that are here in this building and next door, how that really informs our understanding of the disease and how that information can be hopefully translated into better management of the disease. And I think Morag has done a really good example of sort of laying down the foundation for those concepts. And I will likely try to build on that as I take you to the next stage in terms of what happens when those tumor cells leave the primary site and they disseminate throughout the body. And as Michelle said, this is really the most problematic aspect of disease progression in terms of how to treat. So what do we mean when we mean metastasis? So metastasis really means the spread of cancer cells from the primary site or where that tumor initiated to multiple spots throughout the body. And it's a simple concept, but it's a very complicated process, okay? And we can really break down metastasis into a number of discrete steps and stages. So first, it's the growth of the primary tumor, and Morag told you about the complexity and the heterogeneity that comes along with the development of a primary tumor. During the growth of this primary tumor, you usually have the tumor secreting signals that cause blood vessels and lymphatic vessels to grow into the tumor. This not only nourishes the growth of that primary tumor, but also provides an avenue for those tumor cells to escape and disseminate distally throughout the body. So really, there's this second step, which is local invasion of individual or groups of cells away from that primary tumor, and they can either access the lymphatic vasculature or the blood vessels that are surrounding this growing tumor. The third step is really the transit of those tumor cells within the lymphatics or the blood vessels, and ultimately they will arrest in a distant capillary bed. These tumor cells then need to extravasate or leave the bloodstream and colonize a distant site. And it's really, you can think of all of these as barriers to the ability of a tumor cell to leave the primary site and colonize the distant site. Some of these are quite efficient. Some of these are thought to be very inefficient steps. And really, this last step, this really the seeding and the colonization of a distant organ, is thought to be one of the most inefficient steps of this process. And really, then, the subsequent growth of those cells once they establish in the secondary site is what's called a metastasis. So why are we worried about metastases? And as Michelle pointed out, really 90% of cancer-related deaths are associated with the development of metastatic disease. And so if we look at this chart, and I'm sure all of you are familiar with the concept of a tumor grade. And usually tumor grading is used to get a sense of the severity of the cancer. Okay? And so if we break it down in terms of breast cancer, we can have stage 0, stage 1, stage 2, 3, and stage 4. So stage 0 really refers to a non-invasive cancer or a ductal carcinoma in situ. So this is a lesion within the breast that is confined by a basement membrane, and it hasn't invaded locally. It hasn't got into the lymphatics, and it hasn't metastasized distally. If we think about stage 1 tumors, this is a tumor now that's grown a little bit, but it still hasn't spread to local lymphatics or lymph nodes, and it hasn't metastasized distally. When we get to stage 2 and 3, this is now tumors that are growing and increasing size. There may be lymph node involvement close to the tumor, but there's no distant metastasis. And finally, stage 4, this is a tumor of any size that actually shows lymph node involvement and distant metastasis. And if we look at the survival of patients with stage 0 to stage 4, we see that the 5- and 10-year survival rates of stage 4 breast cancer drop dramatically.
I just want you to survive that long, you know.
Okay. Thank you.
I think you'd like that. And I'll put this here. You could put the bottle near the computer, Morag, also.
Okay. So what we can see is that as we progress to stage 4, the 5-year and 10-year survival rates of patients drop dramatically. And this is due to the development of disseminated disease or the development of metastases. Another unique feature of metastatic cancers is that they have a proclivity or a tendency to metastasize to certain organs and tissues. And if we take a look at a number of different cancers, we have lung cancer. When it spreads, it can spread to the brain, it can spread to the bone, it can spread to the liver, the adrenal glands. If we look at breast cancer, these are the typical sites of metastasis for breast cancer. So by far, the majority of patients with breast cancer will develop bone metastases, followed by soft tissue metastases such as lung, liver, and brain. So one of the big questions is, what controls the ability of these tumor cells to metastasize, and why do they display these phenotypes in terms of metastasizing to these unique locations? And really, one of the central hypotheses of metastasis research is the seed and soil hypothesis. And this was a hypothesis that was first posited a long, long, long time ago. But it still represents the central tenet of how we think about metastatic disease. And this is a quote from the original paper from Stephen Paget that suggested that when a plant goes to seed, the seeds are carried in all directions. But they can only live and grow if they land in congenial soil. So in this analogy, the seed is the tumor cell, and the soil is either the primary tumor microenvironment that Morag was talking to you about, or the metastatic microenvironment, so that tissue that these tumor cells find themselves in after they've disseminated. And it's really the ability of these tumor cells to interact with normal host cells that you would find in each of these different metastatic microenvironments that will dictate whether that tumor cell is going to thrive and grow or whether that tumor cell will die. Okay? And so there's a lot of interactions between the tumor cell in terms of what it itself is producing to influence that microenvironment, but it also has to be expressing the right kind of receptors that Morag was talking about in order to respond to signals that might be unique to that microenvironment. So what are the different aspects that sort of control the metastatic ability of tumor cells? Morag did a very nice job of explaining to you how we can now subtype breast cancers. And what's interesting is that those different subtypes are associated with different prognoses. And what's also interesting is that there appears to be a different spectrum of the ability of these tumor cells to metastasize based on the subtype that they are. So if we look at the luminal A and the luminal Bs, the luminal A's are the best prognosis subtype. And look at the degree of metastasis that you see in the bone, the lung, the liver, or the brain. So these predominantly metastasize to the bone only, and very little soft tissue metastases. As soon as we start to move out into the other poorer prognosis subtypes, we begin to see that there's more and more involvement of other organs in terms of the metastases that develop in these patients. And as soon as we get down to HER2-positive or basal disease, there's disseminated metastases in all sites. So this is telling us that the microenvironment that these tumors are growing in and creating as a primary tumor has an impact on if and when these and where these tumor cells are going to metastasize to. So that's part of the equation. The other part of the equation that Morag was also saying is important for the primary tumor is how these tumor cells interact with the microenvironment and the normal cells that are there to do their normal functions within any given tissue. And that's going to have a huge impact on whether a tumor cell will be able to metastasize and colonize the bone, the lung, the liver, or the brain. And if you take a look at these pictures, what you can see is that there's very, very, very different constraints that a tumor cell is going to encounter if it lands in the bone versus the lung versus the liver versus the brain. And this is both architectural, and it's also the different types of cells that are present in those organs and tissues. So if we take the bone as an example, it's a mineralized tissue, right? Very, very different than the primary breast that those tumor cells came from. And it now has to interact with cell types that those cells really haven't had to interact with before. And that has a profound impact on the ability of those tumor cells to do well in this microenvironment or not to. And those molecular mediators, if you will, that toolbox that that tumor cell is going to be able to use will be very, very different in the bone metastatic site versus, let's say, the liver. So that also imposes a selection on these tumor cells that are spreading from the primary site and kind of selects for those tumor cells that would be best adapted to grow in each of those anatomical sites. So I want to use the bone as a site of metastasis. It's an area of interest for my lab. It's the site in which most breast cancers will metastasize to. And I think it illustrates a couple of interesting points about how our understanding of the molecular interactions between tumor cells and host cells has led to the development of a therapeutic. And I think it really underscores the importance of our detailed understanding of the molecular communication between tumor cells and stromal cells. So what you need to know about bone metastases is that it can occur on a gradient of osteoblastic to osteolytic. So really what this means is osteolytic is associated with bone destruction, okay? Loss of bone. Osteoblastic is associated with abnormal bone deposition and formation. And when we're talking about different types of cancer, they can lie on this continuum from osteolytic to osteoblastic. And breast cancer are typically associated as osteolytic lesions, meaning when tumor cells arrive in the bone, they induce a response that leads to an overall net degradation of bone. Okay? But it really should be thought of as a continuum. Okay. So how does it induce bone destruction when these tumor cells arrive in the bone? Well, it does so by being able to communicate and alter the biological activity of resident cells within the bone. And really, I want to introduce you to two types of cells that are resident in the bone. One is the osteoblast. And really, all you need to know is that this is a bone-forming cell. And then there's the osteoclast. And this is a bone-destroying cell. And you have bone remodeling going around in your body at all times. And this is a normal physiological process. And this helps to maintain the strength of your bones. It repairs small fractures due to stress. And it's a normal physiological process. But what happens when you introduce tumor cells into a microenvironment where the interaction between the osteoblast and the osteoclast normally is very tightly controlled? When this happens, you have a disruption of this equilibrium. Okay? And what we found after many, many years of basic research is that the arrival of a tumor cell in the bone marrow can produce certain soluble factors that stops osteoblasts from differentiating into bone-forming cells. It causes these cells to produce a factor, and I'll talk a little bit about that later, which actually causes the formation of new osteoclasts. Normally, this interaction is very tightly controlled, so that you only erode enough bone, and then you replace the same amount of bone. When you have a tumor cell that arrives there, you are now putting the brakes on bone formation, and you're driving the excess production of osteoclasts and the excess bone destruction that you see in an osteolytic metastasis. So how have we been able to leverage this information, right, that's come from our basic research in the lab, to trying to treat and manage bone metastases and breast cancer? And this has really come down to, well, if we can stop the activity of these osteoclasts, and you're likely asking yourself, well, why would a tumor cell care whether there's more osteoclasts and whether those osteoclasts are more active? But by destroying this bone matrix, you can release a number of stored factors in the bone, which actually are go signals for the tumor cell, right? They're growth factors, and they tell these tumor cells to keep dividing, to keep growing. So the idea was that if you could block the activity of these cells, could you maybe impair the ability of these tumor cells to grow and sort of slow the progression of the disease? And so that was the concept behind anti-resorptives, okay, and how this might be able to at least delay the progression of deleterious symptoms associated with bone metastasis. So really the first class of drugs were bisphosphonates, and these are drugs that actually have a high propensity to bind to the mineralized surface of bone so that they can, when this is given intravenously, it circulates throughout the body, but there's higher concentrations that are deposited on bone. And what happens is that when an osteoclast comes along and tries to resorb bone, the bisphosphonates are internalized, and it either impairs the ability of those osteoclasts to resorb bone, or it actually kills them. And that way, you reduce resorption, you reduce the release of these factors, and you can sort of stop the growth of these tumors. The problem with bisphosphonates is that there are side effects, and these are given at very, very high concentrations intravenously, and there tends to be an accumulation of bisphosphonates over time. So you can have renal toxicity, you can have osteonecrosis of the jaw, and there's a concern that once this bisphosphonate is laid down in your bone, it accumulates and it actually stays there over time. So you might have the unwanted effect of diminishing normal bone turnover that's osteoclast mediated. So I told you I'd come back to sort of this factor that tumor cells induce osteoblasts to produce that cause osteoclasts to differentiate. Okay. And this is a protein called RANK ligand. So all you really need to know is that this is very, very important for osteoclasts to form. And they've been able to create an antibody, just like the antibodies that Morag was talking about against the HER2 receptor, to actually bind and neutralize RANK ligand. Okay? And this has the same effect that a bisphosphonate would have in terms of diminishing the ability to induce osteoclast formation. You have less bone turnover, and you have a reduction in the side effects associated with bone metastases. Okay? So I think that this is a really good example of how a targeted biological has come out of a basic understanding of the disease and just understanding how the tumor cell can communicate with these two subtypes or cell types. So I just have a couple slides to finish, and that's really to give you a sense of what we do in the lab. We take two approaches. One is to use breast cancer cell lines that have been around for quite some time, and they represent a particular one of the molecular subtypes that Morag was talking to you about. So we're using a particular tumor cell line called 4T1s. It's just a model for triple-negative breast cancer. And I told you that each of those unique metastatic microenvironments applies a selective pressure for those tumor cells that land there. So we can use the mouse as a way to in vivo select, if you will, tumor cells within a very heterogeneous primary tumor that you've seen from our first talk. individual cells that disseminate and that can land in the lung, the liver, or the bone. And by virtue of that metastatic microenvironment, it selects for a subpopulation within this mixed primary tumor that's very good at metastasizing to the bone, to the liver, or to the lung. And we can apply those same approaches that Morag mentioned in terms of gene expression profiling to understand what each of these subpopulations are expressing. And then that can allow us to go further and ask whether the expression of these genes are meaningful in a functional way. And that will hopefully down the road lead maybe to a target, and then a targeted agent. So that's using an animal model to sort of select out reagents that we can use to understand the disease biologically. And, of course, we interact with our colleagues like Mark, a number of people at the Royal Victoria Hospital, to try to confirm the targets that we get from animal models like this to make sure that they're expressed in human breast cancer and human breast cancer metastases. But more recently, we've reached out and asked, can we start with clinical material? So can we start with metastases from patients handled in the way that Morag described in terms of preserving the quality of that material? Can we laser capture microdissect, as she indicated in her talk, isolate the tumor cells from either the primary tumor or the bone metastasis, and ask what's being expressed in those metastases compared to what's being expressed in the primary? And these expression profiles would be both those inherent gene expression changes of that tumor, but also influences of the microenvironment on those tumors as they sit in situ. And we've been fortunate enough to identify a few targets, both in the bone as well as in the lung, or in the liver, that we're now following up in terms of functional studies. So if I end my slide, or my talk with this slide, really we're very interested in understanding how a tumor cell that grows in the primary can metastasize and seed a variety of different organs and tissues, and how those tumor cells, once they arrive in this metastatic microenvironment, can actually survive the stresses of seeding a distant organ and growing out into a metastasis. And we use both animal models that we develop in the lab, and we try to validate clinically. And also we're now using clinical material as a gene discovery tool that we now take back into our animal models and ask, what's the functional relevance of any targets that we might identify? And with that, I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Peter. So we've heard about basic discovery in the primary tumor and metastasis. I'm sure you also saw the timeline that Morag showed you. It'll take a long time before this, some time to get to the clinic. It's getting shorter and shorter. But many other things are going on in the clinic, and I think Mark is a clinician, a scientist, has been working many years. He's one of the rare ones which has his duty as clinician, but still did fantastic research through the year. He has all sorts of titles that I have to find here. I have in French and English, maybe it's a different title, Mark. Mark is because of his research, in fact, he's the Guerra Family Cancer Scientist. He's a medical director of the Breast Cancer Interdisciplinary Team at the Siegel Cancer Center, and he's also an associate professor of surgery and oncology at McGill University. As soon as it gets this thing going on the other computer, we forgot their password, of course. She's right there. She has the password. You have a password? She has the password. That's good. All this technology and no password. Don't look. Well, that's okay. How many of those would steal the computer here? There may be a few students, though. Just do the password. Nobody will know that your name is Pittle Steele. So we do see nice dots. That's great. Yeah, we're doing well. Excellent. You're on top here. You can just click on it. Yeah. Excellent. Okay. So thank you, Mark, for coming tonight. There you go.
Not quite. Okay.
So thank you very much for inviting me. I was given a very narrow topic to talk about, and that is how do we treat breast cancer. There are only about 1,000 articles coming on breast cancer every month, so it's easy to pick out what's important, isn't it? Well, it's not. So I've been very, very, very selective in what I'm going to be talking about. And, of course, that means I'm ignoring 90% of breast cancer treatments. But I'm going to talk about what's exciting to me and what I think is objectively exciting as well. But here we go. So I have to sit here. Do this. Yeah. Okay, so breast cancer treatment can be divided into two broad categories. What happens locally, that is the breast, and what happens systemically, as we heard already from Peter and Morag, but especially from Peter, the issue about breast cancer is not necessarily what happens there, but what happens out of the breast. That's when that's what kills women with breast cancer and some men, but mostly women. It is, in fact, the spread of breast cancer, metastases. So although what happens locally is important and is important for cosmesis, and it does have an impact a bit on survival, it's what happens systemically is paramount. But I'm going to be talking about both of these categories of treatments. And I'll go over local therapy. Now, local therapy, or how to manage local therapy, how to manage the breast, has been a very interesting area of research and also somewhat controversial. The old idea, the old, shall we say, surgical idea, and I'm a surgeon, so i.e. always stay one step ahead of the cancer cell. In other words, the cancer cell is here, remove all around and a bit more, and you'll be fine. And the cancer cell spread the lymph node, get the lymph nodes, and a little bit more. Of course, that's a problem because you're going to be doing a lot of surgery, possibly. And the question is, does it really matter? Is that really the way cancer biology works, by staying one step ahead of the cancer cell? Well, it may not be, because it may be that, in fact, a lot of cancer surgery is more akin to what the U.S. government did once it figured out there weren't any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That is, shutting the stable door after the war had already started. And that means that it's becoming clear that metastases, or what Peter was showing, happens very, very early on in breast cancer. And so that's why maybe what we do locally is not as important for the actual eventual survival of the woman with breast cancer, but because the metastasis already happened. Of course, we still do the surgery because that is the one way to get rid of the cancer altogether, but we can't just stay there. Nevertheless, there have been quite a few changes, I guess, in the last few years about what we do locally, and most of them have to do with surgery. And in fact, we're doing less surgery than we used to. 50 years ago, we'd be doing mastectomies all the time. And then we found out we didn't have to do mastectomies. We can just do lumpectomies. And then we can do radiation therapy to the rest of the breast to sterilize the rest of the breast and be okay. And then we'd be removing all the lymph nodes to make sure, again, we are that one step ahead. But it turns out that isn't all that necessary either, because lymph nodes seem to be more of a marker. That is, what, as Peter said, the cells have acquired this capacity to spread, and that's what we need to know. We don't need to get out every single last cancer cell in the lymph nodes. It doesn't seem to make that much of a difference if we do. And so we're doing what's called a sentinel lymph node, just checking the lymph node that's closest to the breast, and sometimes even leaving some lymph nodes, some cancer cells behind, and it doesn't even have any impact. And we're doing less mastectomies, as I said. Of course, that since Angelina Jolie made the news, that trend seems to be reversing a little bit. But we can talk about that later.
So, less surgery, but maybe more radiation therapy. Strangely enough, there's some studies that seem to show that if you give radiation therapy to a bit wider area around the breast, not just the breast itself and lymph nodes, it may have an impact on survival, and we're still trying to figure out why that is. And we're also contemplating doing surgery after the horse has already left the barn. And that is because it's, again, not that simple. It seems that metastases, the tumors that have spread, communicate with the primary tumor and vice versa. It's not a simple surgical thing. There's a biology happening between the two. And it seems that sometimes removing the primary tumor, even though it's already spread, may actually slow down what happens outside. But we're still investigating that. And there are clinical trials that are open to look at that now. So this is the traditional sequence of therapy. Surgery of the primary tumor, and then potentially we give other therapy, the systemic therapy that I was talking about, and that usually means chemotherapy or also endocrine therapy if it is responsive to hormones, for what we would call micrometastatic disease. That is, we're getting rid of the primary tumor, we don't see anything anywhere else, but there is a chance, as I said, that things might have spread, and so as a prevention, if you will, we give other therapy like chemotherapy. So this is a standard scheme of things that we used to do, or we still do a lot, and it's called adjuvant chemotherapy. It's an adjuvant to the surgery, or an aid to the surgery. Now, of course, the question is, do we really need to do that, or in which patients can we avoid giving chemotherapy, which is obviously quite toxic? And that's been a big area of research. And there's various ways of various tests that are being now applied on the tumor after it's operated to see whether it's going to be aggressive or not aggressive, to see whether it's more likely to have developed the metastatic disease, the metastatic tumors that Peter is studying. And there's various kinds of these tests. And in fact, they use a lot of these kinds of gene expression arrays that Morag was talking about early on. They're called Oncotype BX, Mammaprint, PAM50, and so on. And they look at the biology. We try to get a handle on the biology of the cells. What they are really looking at often is how fast the tumor cells are actually growing. And that seems to be the most important feature of telling us whether the cells could have spread elsewhere or not. And if we see, in fact, that the cells were growing fast, then we're more likely to give chemotherapy. So there's a lot of research, clinical research, looking at this area over here. Who should be getting other therapy and who should not? And of course, the advantage there is if we can figure out who doesn't need a therapy, you can spare chemotherapy, clearly. But there's a new paradigm that's being used more and more. And that's called neoadjuvant therapy, or new adjuvant therapy, or preoperative chemotherapy. And the idea was this: why don't we try giving the therapy, the chemotherapy, before the surgery? What do we see then? Well, in fact, we will see very often the tumor actually shrink in front of our very eyes. And that's really cool. That's cool for the patient, it's cool for the surgeon because you operate less. And then ultimately what might happen is that the tumor becomes so small or it might even disappear altogether, we're finding. In fact, as the therapies are getting better, and I'll talk about some of them shortly, we are actually seeing rates of what we call pathological complete response. I mean, no tumor cells at surgery, somewhere around 30 up to 40% in some cases. That's amazing. Of course, you can ask me then, why do we operate these patients? Well, if I knew who those patients were before surgery, I wouldn't operate them. But we're looking at that now, too. One of the issues is that the tumor doesn't necessarily shrink like a snowball in the sun, but could shrink in this kind of way. And that becomes a bit more problematic in terms of how much surgery we actually have to do. But this is the new paradigm. And as I said, it means that you can operate less, the amount of surgery you do less. You can do less mastectomies this way, especially if the tumors are very big to begin with. And you can watch the biology of the tumor. And that tells you something about how fast the tumor is growing and so forth. It tells you something about the future. In fact, if you look at this, I'm going to show you a few of these survival curves. In other words, this tells you the proportion that are disease-free. The more flat this line is, the more patients don't have cancer coming back. The more it falls like this, the more it means that the cancers have come back over years. In fact, it shows here that in those patients where you have actually no tumor left at surgery, those patients do amazingly well. Whereas those patients where there is tumor left at surgery, they don't do quite as well, and sometimes don't do well as well at all. So this really tells you something about the prognosis. It would suggest that maybe those patients that have tumors where there's been a lot that hasn't really responded to chemotherapy, maybe we should do after something after the surgery, so perhaps some more chemotherapy to try to address this poor survival. But there's a newer paradigm still, all right? And this is what I call response-guided therapy. It turns out that a German group and others also, what they did, they gave the chemotherapy to the tumor before surgery. In some cases, it began to shrink, but in other cases, it didn't shrink or didn't shrink that much. And then what they did, they had the brilliant idea, why don't we switch chemotherapy? Why don't we try something else? It's really amazing because in a sense, we have a laboratory. We have a tumor cell which we can watch. We can observe a real cancer. We can observe and see what it does to the therapies that we throw at it. And in fact, it may well be that if you change the chemotherapy, well, then a tumor will shrink. So this is what we call response-guided therapy. And this is really hot off the press. This large German study just came out showing that, in fact, if you do this, it may result in a bit of a better survival if you adapt the therapy to what the tumor is actually doing. So this is another advantage of doing the chemotherapy, giving therapy prior to surgery. Again, observing the biology in action. So now I'm going to switch to some of the new drugs that are around that have been found in recent years. I'm going to simply concentrate on three of them. There are many, many. But the three that I think are the most exciting in breast cancer at this point in time, the bullets that are targeting biology. And the first one, I'm going to talk about this type of breast cancer. And more, as I already mentioned, HER2-positive breast cancer. It's about a fifth of breast cancers have this gene, which are many, many copies. These are little nuclei, and the red spots are many, many copies of this gene, many more than you should have. Why? Because this gene makes a protein, a receptor. And this receptor, there are thousands of copies of this receptor when you have many copies of this gene. And it's sort of, this receptor becomes like a motor, an engine to drive the cancer cell. All right? But not only is it a motor, of course, an engine, but the disadvantage is that the cancer cell begins to depend on this motor, on this engine. And so if you can hit that motor engine, you might have a fantastic effect, which is exactly what was shown when Herceptin, the drug that Morag talked about, also was introduced into the clinic. Again, these are the same kind of survival curves. And you see this is when they didn't get this Herceptin drug, and this is when they didn't get their Herceptin drug over here. And when they got it, they did a lot better. Cancer came back less frequently. In fact, the wider this space is between these two lines, the better the effect of the drug is. All right. So this is Herceptin. Herceptin, the great advance in breast cancer treatment in the last decade, in the 21st century. Problem is that it costs a lot, but we can talk about that later. So how does Herceptin work? It's not quite clear still how Herceptin works, but Herceptin attacks this HER2 receptor. It blocks it, shall we say. And the HER2 receptor does all kinds of things downstream. The first thing that it does is actually comes together with other receptors, what's called dimerization, and then it does signaling. It turns on the cell and makes it grow fast. Okay. Well, the new drug that was invented uses that in a way, but in a slightly different way. This is that antibody, Herceptin, which attacks that receptor. And instead of just attacking the receptor, scientists had the brilliant idea of tagging a poison that if you gave to the body just like that, it would be really toxic. It kills cells very easily, so you can't really give it. But if you attach it chemically to this antibody, to this Herceptin antibody, what happens is the following. This antibody with this poison attaches to the receptor. The cell swallows it, and bam, when it swallows it, this poison is released inside the cell, and it kills the cell. So it's a super targeted bomb, all right, that uses this HER2 being produced en masse by these specific cancers to get into the cell and then make it explode. This is T-DM1. In fact, this, I think, is one of the most exciting drugs right now in breast cancer. In fact, if you look at these curves, this is 2012, last year. Again, you have these patients with metastatic breast cancer, right? Where you see, in fact, that the patients that receive this new drug do better than other patients that receive other drugs for this type of breast cancer. So this is, I think, perhaps the most exciting drug right now. In fact, so much so that we have a clinical trial where we're trying it on those patients where, in fact, there is some tumor left after chemotherapy, and those patients are getting this drug or not, and we're going to see if it works to help survival. So HER2, as I sort of mentioned before, doesn't act by itself. There's four of these proteins are very, very similar, and they're a family of proteins, and they work together. What happens is that they actually combine. They make two, and then when this happens, when they kiss, what happens is that you've got this, the cell grows, the cell discharges, and it grows faster. So another idea was, in fact, to prevent this kissing, this dimerization, with this new drug called pertuzumab, or Perjeta, in fact. So this is what happens. You've got this is the molecule of HER2, and it binds at this area, and pertuzumab slaps BAF right there, and it prevents the kissing of these two molecules. So nothing happens, so it's inactivated. So this is another new idea, how to stop these HER2-positive breast cancers. And again, very successful. It works. Not only that, we're actually seeing, I don't think the next slide shows it, yes, we're actually seeing, and this is really, really exciting, that some of these patients, this is survival, might actually be cured of this kind of cancer. And this is metastatic breast cancer, which usually is not very curable at all. So this is also very exciting in terms of a new finding. What's even more interesting, this is a study in which they gave this pertuzumab together with Herceptin, and in one of these groups of patients didn't even give chemotherapy, just these two antibodies together, and it actually shrunk the tumor quite a bit. In fact, it's this group over here, about 20% almost of these tumors shrunk completely without any chemotherapy. So there's really hope now. In fact, the FDA, which is my next little part here, bam, the FDA has just approved giving Herceptin together with this Perjeta or pertuzumab prior to surgery as a way to shrink the tumor, which is more effective than just giving Herceptin. So that's changing also the way we're looking. And we're hoping that as we get more and more efficient at this kind of breast cancer, we'll be able to eradicate it. And of course, this is a very specific kind of breast cancer. It's got this HER2 gene, lots of it. And in a sense, got so much of it that it's like an Achilles heel. It actually depends on it. And so if you take off the Achilles heel, BAF, you kill the cancer. And that's, I think, why we're so successful at this kind of tumor. Now, Morag's work and others has actually gone further to look at the sequence, the actual DNA sequence of tumors. You know, and we're finding mutations in the tumors. That's the way tumors happen. They happen because of mutations in certain genes that make things grow faster. Unfortunately, what we're finding is that these mutations are in different genes in different tumors. And it's somewhat of a disappointment, showing that every tumor, the more we go deeper looking at it, every tumor is really individual. Every patient's, everyone's tumor is different from every other. The deeper we look at it, the more we see is not things in common, but things that are different. So obviously it's going to make therapy very difficult because you can't develop a drug for every patient. But nevertheless, one way to look at this whole thing is to look at the different pathways. These different genes work together in pathways. And maybe there's some pathways that are in fact more affected than others. And that seems to be the case. There's this pathway, a central pathway, which is called the PI3 kinase mTOR-AKT pathway, three genes that work together. It seems to be really, really a central node that controls a lot of the growth and controls the survival of the cancer cells as well. And this pathway is often mutated. There are many genes that are mutated in this pathway to make it work all the time, nonstop, day and night, so the cancer cell can just keep on growing. And so, of course, the idea was to target, was to develop a drug against this pathway. And this is this drug called everolimus, one of many, that hits the central gene in this pathway. And in fact, it's been shown now that it works in the hormone receptor type of cancers. The ones that are dependent on hormones, just like flowers are dependent on water to grow. These cancers that need hormones. And in these particular cancers, this drug seems to be very, very efficient. In fact, these curves, they're pretty wide compared to the other ones you've seen so far. So it's very exciting as well. This is a new form of therapy attacking this particular pathway that is working to to delay the recurrence of the breast cancer once it's spread elsewhere. Everolimus. Yeah, it was up there. It was very small, but yeah, everolimus. So I'm going to end just telling you about a bit about the future. These are all great, and we're hitting these cancers and we're stopping them often, sometimes making them disappear. But cancers are smart. And one of the reasons is that they're clones, and they're not only one clone, they're what's called heterogeneous. If you actually go deeper into the cancer, not only are the cancer cells different, tumors different from each other, from patient to patient, but if you go into the cells, the actual cells within the tumor are different from each other as well. There's variety inside the cancer cell too. And that's one of the issues, because you might be able to kill one of the types of cells, but another one might not be killed and might come, and that's why the cancer would come back. So I think it's becoming more and more important to begin to analyze these tumors in greater depth, not only just to look at the whole cancer, to look at the normal cells around, like Morag was saying, but to start picking apart the different parts of the cancer itself so we can understand where the resistant cells are, where the sensitive cells are. And one of the ways we're doing that, and this is a study, we're actually doing biopsies prior to surgery, prior to chemotherapy, and giving the treatment, and then seeing what happens after. In other words, seeing how this has changed compared to that. Analyzing this, and seeing the differences so we can understand what evolved in the cancer. So we can then target these cells specifically. And these are these biopsies that we're doing prior to treatment, giving treatment, and then taking biopsy after treatment as well, if there's something left. So that's all I wanted to say. That's sort of, I think, the present and the future also of cancer treatment development is to go deeper into the cancer cell and to try and understand how it evolves and to look for pathways that are altered so they can be targeted by these bullet drugs that may work very well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Quite a nice... So we hear quite a lot now about novel directions, novel treatments. And as Mark mentioned, there's, again, a large number of drugs already in clinical trials at different places using these approaches in many ways. So we're reaching the end of our very scientific portion, although the next speakers could have continued that. Dr. Beauchemin is a full professor at the biochemistry department and at the cancer center, the Goodman Cancer Center. She's been working for quite a long time. She has a white gray hair like me. 25 years only on cancer research. And things have changed in her life when herself became a patient. And she, I must say to you that she's a colleague for many, many years. She's been volunteer for the Canadian Cancer Society at many places, talking one day on her research the other day about her experience. So she will be the testimonial speaker tonight. Nicole, thank you very much.
Thank you. Normally, patients don't have PowerPoint slides, but once a professor, always a professor. And hopefully, it's also to keep me in focus and on time so that we can answer your questions. So this is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And I think you will understand from my story that I'm a very lucky person, because what happened to me 12 years ago, 2001, we all remember what happened in 2001. I was undergoing chemotherapy when the planes hit. So, my mother was a nurse, and the one thing she drilled into me when I was a young girl, if there's one thing you never miss every year, it's your exam, your gynecological exam. And of course, as you grow older, then the gynecological exam also includes breast exam and mammography. And I'd been systematically going for my mammography every year. That particular year, I almost didn't go. I was busy. I had a grant due, as we always do. Why I got up and actually went to the clinic is a bit of faith. I had somebody very close to me that year that passed away from colorectal cancer. He was my favorite uncle. And he should have lived, but it was misdiagnosed, and he did not. And I remember very well sitting in the same office where I am now, looking out the window, and just as I was about to say, I won't go, asking or telling myself, first of all, what would my mother say? Second of all, what if there was something? How could I live with myself? I'm a cancer researcher. I can't do this to myself. So I picked up, and I went to the clinic. And one of the reasons why we hate going to these clinics is, at least in those days, but I don't think it's changed much, you wait. And you wait. And the exams are not the most pleasant that you have to undergo. And so I went for the mammography. They took the first pictures. And the technician brought me back. You're a cancer researcher. You sort of know that something either happened to the machine, or the film was dropped in the developing machine and they can't find it, or something, you have something in your breast. And so we repositioned again, and I waited, saw the radiologist, who said, do you have a few hours? Yeah. I think we'd better run some more tests. So they did see very close to the chest wall on my right breast something that could have been a tumor. This was 12 years ago. Not many clinics had echo machines. This one did. And a resident that was well trained in it was coming in to look at this. So we go through the procedure. What do I know about breast cancer? I'm a colon cancer researcher. What do I know about breast cancer at that point? Well, you can't live in a center without getting a few things. What I know is that if I am going to have a cancer, they could probably puncture and get some cells and send them for pathology, which is what they did. What I also knew is that if when they puncture, there's a little bit of liquid that comes out, it's probably going to be a tumor. So I'm there just looking, and I see some liquid. So I knew right there that there was a tumor. My whole thing was, how bad was it going to be, and was it going to be metastatic? Primary tumor, they can excise. So the longest 3 weeks of my life was waiting for pathology, and that, ladies and gentlemen, has not changed. It still is the longest time. I read up everything I could find on the internet. I saw that if the pathology came back and they could have, like, in cells which are in an Indian file, bad news. Guess what it was? Bad news. Aggressive cancer, invasive cancer. But it was very early. I went through, so he called the woman, not the, the colon cancer researcher, went through the same disconnect that most patients feel. You've probably seen these ads from, I think it was either the Canadian Cancer Society or the Cancer Research Society, where a patient is told the news that she has cancer, and it's a silent commercial, and you see her just going back, and you see the family just totally stunned. This doctor kept on talking. I couldn't hear a thing. All I heard was, this is most likely lobular breast cancer. And that was it. And we just went on. And then I was handled by nurses and clinical trials people. And it's like, here you go. They say all sorts of things, but you really don't hear it because you're in some kind of a bubble. And so after the pathology came back, I was lucky enough to be treated in a clinic that was well organized. And so at the moment that you are diagnosed, you are essentially channeled through a number of services, and your treatment is essentially programmed for the next 6 to 8 months, which it was. So this was diagnosed June the 8th, 2001. I underwent surgery July 11, 2001, and I started chemotherapy August 13th of 2001. How do I remember this? Well, July 11th happened to be one of my best friend's birthdays. August 13th, I would have been teaching the medical students about DNA repair systems, which is essentially what chemotherapy was going to do to me. I was offered a number of treatments. I remember very well going with Morag to get a second opinion on the treatments. And essentially, in those days, the best was you go for lumpectomy. It was small enough at that point that we can do this. Chemotherapy, 4 treatments. So this put me all the way to mid-October. And remember, 2001, anybody remember what was happening then? You had to wait for radiotherapy. I was offered to go to the United States, free trip. I didn't go. I stayed. I wanted to be close to the people who were helping me go through this time. And the province actually sort of opened up more positions at that time, so I was able to get my treatments at the Montreal General for 6 weeks, and I finished December 28th. And there was a huge snowstorm, December 29th. And I remember very well that the one thing I didn't want to have to do is go up to the Montreal General in a snowstorm. So I beat the snowstorm. And then I thought, although I knew about the treatments, I thought this would be it. But unfortunately, I have a body that responds very much to medication. And so it was ER-PR positive, HER2 negative, so I was offered tamoxifen treatment, which I took for 2.5 years. Why did I stop at that point? When you are a researcher and you can no longer pick up a pen because you're hurting all over, that was it. So I said, okay, we'll try something else. And then I went through systematically a number of aromatase inhibitors. My cancer was a 1C, a stage 1C, very early. If I had waited 1 year, I probably wouldn't be here tonight. I'm just lucky. No one is ever ready for this diagnosis. And even though I may be a cancer researcher, there is a dichotomy in all of us between our work and the personal person that you are. And it took me some time to reconcile both of them together. I think one concern I had throughout, at least at the very beginning, was how my body was going to adapt to these treatments. Chemotherapy, for me, was probably the worst time in my life. Some of the anti-nausea medications didn't work, and I actually had to go back in emergency. But I've been teaching medicine at that point for 15 years. And so you get wheeled into emergency, and they say, ah, Dr. Beauchemin, because it's one of your students. And they had trouble figuring out what was wrong. And when they actually gave me some anti-nausea medication, a couple of hours after, that was fine. I went in back another time because I thought I was having a heart attack. What it was some of the medication that I was receiving to boost up my blood was actually creating the bone marrow to synthesize a lot of blood, and my sternum was just hitting and hurting. And the residents couldn't figure it out. We had to wait for the specialist the next morning. She was not a happy camper. Why I'm here? I'm here because I went for regular medical exams. I went because I believed in them, and I am still convinced that they saved my life. I'm here because technicians picked up on something tiny that could have been a tumor. And I'm here because some physicians basically said, we need to do more tests and we need to make sure what you have. One should never, never accept to shut your eyes on a condition that you're living, where you feel so extraordinarily tired and you don't know why. Where you have symptoms. You think you're feeling a lump in your breast. It needs to be investigated because you should know your body and you should be aware of what might be developing. If it's nothing, fine. Somebody will tell you it's nothing after proper investigations. But don't wait. Make sure to fully pursue all the tests that are recommended because they all sort of look at something different, and it actually may be rather important. The treatments are really difficult, at least they were for me. I know some people go through them, and they don't feel so terrible, but they were for me. They were physically very challenging. They're also psychologically very demanding on the patients and on their families. Not only do you have to be in the hospital every day when you're undergoing radiotherapy, the week you get chemotherapy, it's a wasted week because you're just trying to recover. The more accumulation of these treatments that you get, of course, you've lost your hair by then. That's a minor detail. What it does to your stomach and your intestine is fantastic. Cleans you out. You get fatigued, and you don't know why, and you expect that it shouldn't be doing this. And, of course, you get burned to a crisp with radiotherapy. I was wearing extra, extra large T-shirts in the end so they wouldn't stick to my skin that was thoroughly burned. There was only one cream, a medicated cream, that I could put on there. And I remember riding up to where my husband has his home on Côte-Nord. It's a 10-hour drive on our Quebec roads, you know. And so this T-shirt kept going up and down on the breast. I've never been so happy to get there. My greatest worry, but I'm sure it's most patients, is whether or not the treatments will actually work for you. Is this just the beginning of it? And will it be till the end of my life nonstop? Well, for me, it's been 12 years. I would say the first 3 years were... The first year was really difficult. The second year was depressing. It's like, how is it that I'm not getting my energy back? How is it that I can't run around the lab and write all these grants? How is it that I can't deal with family issues? I was just tired, and it took a long time before I got my energy back. You also get a tremendous amount of information, and to some degree, it gets to be information overload. You need to be able to deal with them. I needed help, honestly. There was a point where I couldn't... I remember phoning a friend of mine saying, this is it. I'm not going for this fourth chemotherapy treatment. I don't know why I need a fourth... I'm a scientist, right? I'm supposed to know that I needed the fourth because it's sort of an incremental effect, and the fourth was as necessary as the first one, if not more. And he took 2 hours to convince me. He said, if I have to go and pick you up and sit you down in that chair, I will do it, but you need to go. It's not because you're a scientist that you integrate all of this. And if you don't understand these things, and you're just someone who's trying to get through the system, it's probably even worse. So there is a lot of information you need to deal with. The long wait for results was agonizing. I think it's better. I think the system has understood finally that patients need to know a little bit more. There are a lot of organizations which can give you some information and help you. There are a lot of volunteers that can be there to help you. But most of all, the patients really need the help of their families and their friends. It is a very particular time in one's life, and it's very difficult to go through it. The changes that are brought on by the disease when you're actually going through the treatment. There's a lot of loneliness. here I am going to work every day, spending huge amount of time, and all of a sudden, I'm confined at home with my cat. Person to talk to is my cat. You know, it's just like, where is all the thrill and excitement of my everyday life? Is it ever going to come back? Will I be able to connect with people? It seems like nobody really understands what you're going through. And I used to find that the only people I could actually connect with were the other patients in the waiting rooms that were all undergoing the same treatments. They understood what I was talking about. It seemed like even though people were trying to communicate with me, I didn't think that they understood. The stares from everyone. Yes, so not having hair doesn't really matter. I had light. Somebody came up with a box of really nice silk chiffon headgears, and I wore that. But first thing I found is when September, October rolled around, wow, this is really cold. No hair, and it's really cold. So I got myself some great hats that I wore for some time. And then the hair grew back, and it was all dark, and it was all curly. This is not me, you know? So it took many years for it to straighten out, actually. People look at you. You're waiting for a bus. You're shopping. You're doing your grocery shopping. And people look. They don't look. They stare at you. And it's really difficult to take because you're not sure what they're thinking. And very few people actually come up to you and sort of question, or some will actually smile. So sometimes this can be very difficult. Patients are very lonely because as the treatments progress, you sort of tend to isolate yourself because, first of all, you're tired and you can't do very much. And second of all, you don't want to be infected because it could have serious consequences. And so you essentially stay away from people, and it's sort of a two-way street. Most of the people around me wanted to help and most likely did a great job. My family was there. My husband and my immediate family was there for every chemotherapy treatment. I had some people staying with me the first week and trying to feed me, which was essentially useless. But again, they have trouble understanding what your needs can be, and you need to be very clear. If you are undergoing this period of your life, it is important that you try and explain exactly to them what you're going through because they won't understand it. The temporary loss of coworkers and family essentially is difficult to integrate. It just sort of isolates you. The fact that you were a productive member of your community and all of a sudden you're no longer doing what you were doing and like best, and you know, you're free in the middle of the day to go shopping. You know, when you're young enough, people wonder why you're free to be going shopping in the middle of the day. The lack of communication of certain family members can be very difficult to take. I had somebody very close to me who was not able to handle this. And somebody I love very much, and he just was not around. And it was really hard for me to understand why he couldn't pick up the phone and phone me and say, hey, how are you? Is there anything I can do for you? It was too hard for him. It took years, and I finally understood. Patients are very focused on their disease. And even though you have a lot of other things going on in your life, you somehow suspend it for a few months. And all you think about, all you talk about is your disease. So you're partly responsible. But then it's an intense experience. And not easy to sort of forget that other people are living through different stories in their lives. So what did I take out of this? that living with cancer treatments is very difficult and complex, and it'll bring about a lot of changes in your life because you're continuously facing your own mortality. And it's fine to do this when you've had half a bottle of wine and you're sort of discussing this with friends, but it's another story when you're facing it every day. Therapies clean out your body, but they also clean out your psyche. You want changes in your career, you want changes in your personal relationships, and you might even want changes in your future and how you're going to go about the rest of your life. Getting back to my old self, my old 90%, 90 because I figured, well, now I'm 12 years older, so I can take the age factor in there. It takes many years. I think it took 5 years. I mean, Michelle was my boss, so there were quite a few interactions between he and I. But he understood. after spending a lot of time, you want to find out what was responsible for your cancer. You then decide that you want to change things in your life. And one of the things that's changed is I want productive interactions in my life. And I want to be able to, if there's one thing I can't stand, I couldn't stand it before, but it's even worse now, going to some of these meetings where nothing gets decided. I can't stand that. If I can't walk away from a meeting and we've decided on something and we're going to act on it, it just seems to push the wrong button. I am definitely enjoying my life as it is. What encourages patients to keep on fighting, and I've interacted with a lot of patients over the years, is the fact that there is extraordinary research being done. I remember very much when we went to consult, one of the questions I asked this clinician at that point, what if this comes back? What will you have? So that was 12 years ago. What will you have then to cure me? And he said, he explained there was a lot of research being done. And, you know, he explained what was at the forefront at that time. Now I hear Mark, and I feel like, yes, I'm okay. If I get metastasis of this breast cancer, because it can recur, it can still recur, he's got good tools, and I should be able to at least have a good enough time to live through this. I want to leave you with this. What did I learn out of this? Human beings are fantastically resilient. I never thought I'd get through this. And everybody thinks that. And once you've gone through the experience, you realize that you have forces within you that you can tap into. This is important. The Quebec medical system works reasonably well. I did not expect that it would be so efficient. I thought, because we heard it then, and I think we still hear it now, how long we wait and how long it takes for tests. Yes, I'm sure you could all tell me stories that would go against this. But altogether, from the beginning, from the surgery, to still today, the tests that I'm undergoing, I have been followed, I have been questioned, I have been listened to, and I was essentially treated in a very reasonable amount of time, and very well. We need to take better care of our bodies and our minds, and that is really the most important message. We need better prevention and better detection tools. And this is what we're all working for in our respective cancers. Too many treatments then were nonspecific. Now it's changed quite a bit. The next generation will be definitely more personalized. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Nicole, for this testimony. In fact, I don't remember you were not a nice person ever. So let me tell you that these days were, always Nicole has been a fantastic scientist and co-worker. So we'll have now, we have a few minutes, about 10 minutes for asking questions. So if I would like to have the speakers to come in front. And what I will do is, I'm sure some of you will have questions on their hands. I can pick them up and ask the questions. So it's a good time if you want to escape. We'll escape there, but we're not going to make this too long. So about 15, 20 minutes will be good. Okay. Okay, I'll keep them by the time they go. So we go. Nicole, are you going to sit down with them too? You may have a question for them. Okay. So we'll start immediately. There's a first question for Mark, I suppose. Mark, it's related to the Emerolimus drug. Is it currently available to patient?
Does it work now?
Yes.
It is sort of available right now. It's coming into availability. It's been approved by the FDA. England did not approve it, and Canada, not quite, but close. I think it's on its way. The problem is that they're waiting still some further follow-up data for these patients, but it is possible to get it with certain special programs, compassionate use. So, yes, some of my patients have received it here in Quebec.
Okay, so it's available here in Quebec even, and sometimes. Okay, does a son have a higher risk of developing prostate cancer if his mother has breast cancer? Do the risk double if the father has prostate cancer and the mother has breast cancer? So we're looking at the real domino effect here that we want to know about. So I don't know if we want to take these questions. That could be basic scientists too, or Mark, if you're ready to go, it looks like. You're warm up. So we'll go.
No. We didn't talk about prevention tonight and genetic basis of disease, but yes, there is a link. Many men get prostate cancer. Most of them, there's no link, but there is a link. There's a gene called BRCA2. We didn't talk about that tonight. It's a whole other chapter where there is, in fact, a link with hereditary breast cancer and an increased risk of getting prostate cancer in men. It's also of note that these carriers of mutations in this gene, some of the men actually get breast cancer as well. So there is a link, but it's not a very big link. Because prostate cancer is so common as is breast cancer,
so
most of the time it's not.
So the unlikeliness is mainly related to genes which are involved in DNA repair or things like that. This question is very much like that. I'll send it to Morag. What type of research is being done regarding any possible connection between breast cancer and other type of woman cancer, for example, ovarian cancer? And why do some women survive ovarian cancer treatment and years later develop breast cancer? So is there a relationship?
I'll take this one. Okay, so right, I'll stay with this one. So this is really just to reiterate what Mark said about inherited breast cancer with changes in two genes that we know of. One is called BRCA1 and another is called BRCA2. And there is an association between the development of ovarian cancer and mutations in BRCA2. And those women will have a potentially increased incidence of breast cancer as well. And I can't remember what the second part of the question was.
I think the second question was, which I put there. No, I did not. What was the question? Sorry, I destroyed the question. But you raised one thing. I will follow up on that because Mark mentioned it a bit earlier with our famous actress, which got preventive mastectomy. Can you talk a bit about that with BRCA1 and BRCA2 patient?
That's a whole subject.
But just at least quickly mention it because I think raised this issue, so I think it would be okay.
Women who are carriers of mutations in BRCA1, BRCA2, and some other genes, but especially those two, are at very high risk of getting breast cancer, and that we're talking about somewhere in the order of 50 to 70%. And therefore, there are several options. One of them, the most radical option, obviously, is to remove the breast. So that has been shown to almost completely remove the chance of getting breast cancer. But many women elect to be followed as well with yearly imaging, yearly MRIs, mammograms, and so on, very, very carefully. Every 6 months we see them. And there's also another option. You can take some medication that decreases the risk of getting breast cancer, especially in the BRCA2. So there are several options, and it's very much, I think, a personalized decision. Not everyone, and it very much depends on, you know, the experience that you've had in your family. You know, if you've seen your mother die at a younger age or your sister, then obviously you're much more concerned and you might be more willing.
Again, to very surgery. Specific genes identified on these patients. There's other questions on that. For Morag, what is the most common cancer for women? If breast cancer is coming the second, is breast cancer coming the second most common cancer? Next one?
So breast cancer is the most common cancer in women, but what I said was death from breast cancer is the second leading most frequent death of breast from breast cancer is the second most frequent death from cancer. The most frequent death from cancer in women and in men is lung cancer. And we know many of the causes of lung cancer, and indeed there's a direct correlation, as we know, between smoking and the development of lung cancer.
But they still deserve treatment. It's still important to do lung cancer research. So on that, though, the question is the age of the woman related to the kind of breast cancer she develops? Can you find an age?
That's a very good question.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, Mark, in fact, all of us sitting here are participating in a study at the moment, or we're building a study to look at young women with breast cancer. And here we're looking at women below 45. And there is some evidence to suggest that young women with breast cancer tend to develop what's called this triple negative subtype that I was talking about. But it's not that they exclusively develop that type. They will also get estrogen receptor positive and the HER2 amplified types of breast cancer. And so it's not clear why young women would tend to have a higher incidence of triple negative breast cancer. It may be that this is a developmental process. It may be related to age of onset of breast cancer, and these tend to be tumors that grow faster, whereas the other ones take a longer time to be diagnosed and detected. So these are really important questions that we're looking at now.
And the person that asked this question also asked, how effective is mammogram for diagnosing breast cancer? Is this important only for postmenopausal women or for young women also, since we looked at women which are much older for mammograms, right?
So that's another very important point. And the challenge with young women is that their breasts tend to be denser than older women. And it's more difficult to identify a tumor or a cancer which is also dense in breasts that themselves are dense. So that's why the recommendation for mammography is to start as you get older, and that's why it's more easy to detect the tumors in older women whose breasts, by default, tend to be less dense.
I have a question for Peter. They did not forget you. They did not forget you. Here's how soon after being diagnosed with breast cancer, metastasis could be diagnosed. So in your mind, in your basic science view of this, and after Mark can answer the clinical real data on a daily basis, how fast you think somebody could be diagnosed from metastasis? How fast is this going?
So I think that we used to think of the development of a primary cancer in terms of development of the primary tumor, evolution of different subpopulations with that tumor that then selected for something that was highly aggressive, and that those cells could then disseminate and establish a secondary metastasis. So we used to think this as a relatively sort of a later event in the progression of that primary tumor. But now what we're learning is that some of these cancers, like triple-negative cancers, because of the features of the cells that compose that tumor, these might be escaping when that lesion is, when that tumor is very, very small. And that it could be that they disseminate, they land in a distant organ, such as the bone, and that there's this possibility that they may be resident there for a while and then sort of reemerge as a recurrence many, many years afterwards, and sort of this concept of dormancy. So, and what's what's causing those tumors to reawaken once they've disseminated early, again, is sort of a big question.
So Mark, is every patient diagnosed for primary tumor immediately? People are looking for metastasis immediately?
No, most, thank goodness, thanks to mammography, and we're diagnosing breast cancers early like it was for Nicole, but there's a small percentage of patients, about 5%, that present with obvious metastatic disease. Most of them do not, which is great. And most of the time, metastases can develop any time afterwards, and it depends on the kind of tumor, as Peter was saying. And the more aggressive ones, you'll know in the first 2 years, 3 years. And the more indolent ones, the less aggressive ones, it could happen even later. Mm-hmm. So we continue following patients for a long time.
There's another question of this person, which is very interesting. So how soon should someone go for genetic testing for breast cancer? Of course, it's interesting because there's no such test, as far as I know. Caprion in Montreal just advertised, as you know, a blood test for lung cancer. So is there something like that in breast cancer coming up?
Okay, he's given it to me, so it's obviously... Well, I can say some things that we are beginning to detect what are called either circulating tumor cells or even markers that are DNA that are released from dying tumor cells that we can begin to detect in the circulation. These are not really ready yet for early detection. These tend to be used once you've identified that you've got a tumor and is the tumor responding to treatment, for example. But clearly, these are types of approaches that could be used for earlier detection. And because that these are blood-based tests, these are much easier to apply to a larger population.
So the question here is that in the lymph node, sentinel lymph node, do you do genetic testing on these cells, or is just a positive marker of keratin, for example, that the tumor is already in the lymph node? Do you do tests, genetic tests, on the lymph node cells?
We don't have to, because most of the time we do it on the tumor that we have with it. But it is true that there are changes that happen when the tumor goes to the lymph nodes, and that we're looking at more and more. We're actually analyzing those tumor cells and seeing that there are some mutations that are in the, when it gets to the lymph nodes, it didn't have when it was a primary tumor. And that's an area of very intense research.
Can you say something about men breast cancer? They are cases, they're rare. But, there's
1 in 100. For every 100 women, there's a man that gets breast cancer. We don't know much about it because it's relatively rare. But as far as we know so far, it's not that different from women's breast cancer.
So do you bank men breast cancer?
We have a few, actually, but very few. And again, it's related to the incidence of male breast cancer.
Okay, very good. There's a question. I'm going to wait because it looks too complicated for me to read. Are Oncotype DX and MammaPrint being used on new patient right now? So if a patient is diagnosed, do you have this? Are Jewish, for example, other places?
Yeah. The Quebec government funds Oncotype DX in the right particular cases where it's actually where it's been shown to be actually useful to decide whether chemotherapy or not should be given.
So the government pays for it?
Yes.
Yeah, here in Quebec.
MammaPrint, no.
Okay. We talked about bone metastasis, and what caused calcium deposit in these bones? And is it as serious as the, you know, osteoclast activations and degradations of bone? So we saw a nice, X-ray that you had showing bone deposit.
Right.
So what is this?
So in terms of prostate cancer, that's typically more blastic than breast cancer,
so
which is
prostate cancer.
Yeah, so they tend to be characterized as mixed or blastic. But their activated osteoblasts are also producing a lot of factors that these tumor cells can respond to, right? So and the bone that's being deposited in those cases isn't what you would call normal bone, right? So it's sort of weak or new bone. So you can still have fractures associated with prostate cancer, even though you're thinking there's new bone being formed, right? But there are still fractures that occur, and you can have... And really, it's a continuum of lytic and blastic, and likely the metastasis goes through a phase where there is some osteoblastic and there is some osteolytic activity, because bisphosphonates will work in prostate cancer as well, right? So,
thank you very much. We're getting at the end, but a few more questions and we go. There's one question that I'm not sure any of you can answer, but or maybe. Can we have a copy of the presentation? One person says, I think it's on the web. So it's the entire presentation is on the web. You'll be able to see this from the Cancer Center website. Tamoxifen, I continue a few questions because people took the time to write those questions. So tamoxifen and arimidex, which is an aromatase inhibitor, are currently prescribed for limited time periods, such as 5 years. And Nicole or Mark can answer that. Why is this? And what happens after 5 years, Nicole? Do you get something else?
I didn't want anything else. I went for 6.5 years. I mean, we know, and there are some patients that will continue. A lot of patients don't have all the side effects that I have. Some patients don't really see a difference, and, you know, if they can take it, they can remain on it as far as I know. But those people like me who have all... There are 15 side effects to tamoxifen. I had 14 of them. The last one was uterine cancer. I didn't get that.
Okay. Mark, anything to add to that? Yeah.
No, there is... the standard therapy used to be 5 years of endocrine therapy, but there is more and more data suggesting that giving it for another 5 years is beneficial. So we're now beginning to do that in women that have a higher risk of it coming back. For instance,
is this paid also by the government?
Yes.
The next 5 years?
Yes, yeah. So, for instance, if you have lymph node, if it went to your lymph nodes from the beginning, then in those cases we're beginning to think about giving it another 5 years, so a total of 10.
Okay, thank you. One interesting note here, a world of thanks to the mice who have died and suffered for us. I must say to you that as a director of the Cancer Center, I've answered this question for many, many years. We do have very tight protocols to use all animals from the Canadian Council for Animal Care. We have people from the public, and you're all welcome. If anybody of you wants to volunteer to be on animal committees, we do search people from the public. I would also ask Morag to say something about the patients which give their tumors to the bank. That's also a lot of people we have to thank. Maybe you can add to that.
And I do want to reiterate the fact that people have donated their tissue and allowed their tissue to be banked, and importantly banked with the linked information, the clinical information and outcome, has revolutionized how we think about cancer. This gives us the tools now to really begin to understand the disease and, as Mark said, begin to understand how different patients respond to different chemotherapies or to different treatment protocols. And it's in the 10 or 12 years that we've been banking, we've essentially had nobody that's refused their tissue to be banked. Now we have some challenging questions because I think, as I mentioned in my talk, we can actually grow human tumors in mice. So that means we're actually keeping these tumors alive for prolonged periods of time. So this is exciting for us because we can actually treat these tumors in mice with new types of therapy. So this is like a living incubator, and we can ask questions which are related to, do the tumors respond to these treatments and do they not? Now, that may be important for patients if they return with metastatic disease. But, of course, you have to remember, in a research setting, we don't link back to the patients in the clinic.
I think that's very important.
But it's an ethical challenge because we do keep these tumors alive indefinitely, and people have to think about whether they're prepared to allow us to do that. But what I'll say is this will change how we treat cancer. We will begin to bring these types of tools into real-time settings where we can make these tests within a short period of time once the tumor has been removed from the patients. Not there yet, but these are the goals that we're doing.
Thank you very much. I have three questions left. This one is for Mark again. So there's a person in the audience which write, what about the drug tamoxifen versus aromatase inhibitors? The person herself fail on tamoxifen, and the so what is the advantage of one versus the other? Is there any? Can you say something about that?
Yeah, I mean the big advancement, I guess, in the treatment of hormone dependent breast cancer was the development of these aromatase inhibitors. So what happens is that tamoxifen blocks the effect of estrogen on the cancer cells. It blocks it. What aromatase inhibitors do? They actually stop the estrogen being made in the body. All right, and surprisingly enough, even after you've gone through menopause, you still have estrogen being made, mostly in the fat cells in the body. And that's when these drugs, these aromatase inhibitors, are used after menopause. That's where they've been shown to be at least as effective as tamoxifen. So there are lots of clinical trials that are compared to two. They basically turn out to be, after menopause, better, a little bit better than tamoxifen, but probably the best thing is to combine them in some way.
Which I think you had one after the other, I think, Nicole. One question of that person also. Is it possible the breast cancer metastasized to skin, to make skin cancer?
Yes.